Scalpel with Dr. Keith Rose. Cutting down to the truth through history and experience, The Scalpel is proudly sponsored by Z-Bone's bone-conducting headphones. Learn more at zbones.io. Subscribe to The Scalpel wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at The Scalpel Podcast, on Twitter at The Scalpel Edge, or the website scalpeledge.com. The next episode of The Scalpel starts now.
This out from Bloomberg, February 10th. The flu is killing up to 4,000 Americans a week. The article goes on, the amount of influenza ravaging the U.S. this year rivals levels normally seen when an altogether new virus emerges, decimating a vulnerable population that hasn't had a chance to develop any defenses. It is an unexpected phenomenon that public health experts are still trying to decode. The level of influenza-like illnesses being reported now are as high as the peak of the swine flu epidemic in 2009 and exceed the last several flu season outbreaks since 2003 when a new strain started circulating, said Ann Shushat, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's acting director. Swine flu, which swept the globe in 2009 and 2010, sickened over 60 million Americans, hospitalized 274,304 Americans, and killed 12,469, according to CDC data. But deaths from this current outbreak will likely far outstrip the 2009 to 2010 season. The article goes on to say, it's a difficult season. We can't predict how much longer the severe season will last. I wish there was better news, but everything we're looking at is bad news. Shat went on to say the agency's virologists are studying it to determine if there are any other explanations for why it's so hard-hitting. We still have a lot to learn, she said. It's a wake-up call on how severe influenza can be, and we can't let down our guard. Deaths from influenza and pneumonia, which are closely tied to each other in the winter months, were responsible for one of every 10 deaths last week. And that's likely to rise, Shushat said in a conference call Friday. There were 40,414 deaths in the U.S. during the third week of 2018, the most recent data available, and 4,064 in that 1 week were from pneumonia and influenza, according to CDC data. The article goes on to say the number for that week is expected to rise as more reports are sent to this agency. It gets worse. The death toll in the future weeks is expected to grow even higher because flu activity is still rising, and the number of deaths follow the flu activity. Hospitalization rates are already approaching total numbers seen at the end of the flu season, which may not be for months. Unfortunately, more deaths are likely to happen, Shushat said. Over the next few weeks, we expect and would make sense to see more pneumonia and influenza-related deaths. People are likely to die who are already in the hospital. She also said this year's flu could be more calamitous than outbreaks going back decades, but there's no way to know for sure. The agency also reported another 10 deaths amongst children, bringing the total to 63 so far this season. That's an article like I started with, February 10th, 2018. Just a little over 2 years ago. Bloomberg put out an article that was factual that the flu is killing up to 4,000 Americans a week. Welcome to The Scalpel. This is Dr. Keith Rose. We are in unprecedented times in our country today. As I look back at over 21 years of practicing medicine, I have never seen a response or a crisis quite like this. I was in Africa when Ebola broke out. I was in the Middle East during H1N1. I was also overseas when swine flu hit. I was around with a lot of bad diseases over time, but I never saw a response like I'm seeing today. And the reason I wanted to start with this article from Bloomberg is because it quotes CDC data, CDC data that is much worse than the actual data we're seeing today from coronavirus, from COVID-19, from Wuhan virus, from the China virus. Yet we have a response in this nation that is shaking Americans to the core. It is fracturing society, and it is shocking the conscience of the American people. A lot of folks are sitting in their homes and they're frightened. There is fear being peddled at a rate I've never seen it quite pushed out before. Mainstream media has become the panic merchants in this drama, and they seem to want to peddle more fear, more doom, more gloom, more what if, and very few people are looking at what is. This virus didn't just start. It didn't just come to America when it was originally reported on January 15th, although that was around the time the first case was actually diagnosed. So today I'm going to take you through the actual data. I'm going to try to support my opinion that we need to stop reacting to what if and start responding to what is. Because the way I see it, as a physician, as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, and as someone that has spent his entire adult life traveling around the world and working in medicine and small business, the perfect storm is here. It's not the perfect storm of the worst pandemic we've ever had. It's not the perfect storm of a failing medical system. No, it's just the perfect storm of unscrupulous politicians, a corrupt mainstream media linked at the hip with those unscrupulous politicians, and a nation state that has recognized a fatal weakness in our country. That's an unfree press, hat tip Mark Levin, that will push a narrative for ideological gain. And they don't care if it takes the nation straight down economically, morally, or physically in our healthcare system. I wish I had better news for you today, but I'm glad you're here. I pray that you'll share this with everyone you know. I don't do this for money. I'm doing it because someone has to stand up and speak the truth. I have to be responsible for my actions, and more importantly, I've got to be responsible for my inaction. And I wish more doctors, more researchers, more scientists would stand up and say what is so obvious. It is the 800-ton gorilla in the room. And that's, why aren't we looking at the data and adjusting for it? Why are we listening to mouthpieces on mainstream media, Democrat politicians, and some Republican politicians? Why are we listening to career bureaucrat scientists and doctors and not looking at the data and the actual information we have now? From a scientific perspective, from a historical perspective, and from a perspective that says we are a nation of free people. We're not a nation of cowards. We should be able to look at this data, make strong, wise decisions, and move on. But we're not doing that. Now, like I said, this virus hit in early January. But I will tell you, and I'm going to support this, I believe it was here much sooner. But when the virus was here, I will tell you, it was really hard for the Democrats to pay attention at that time, because in January, they were in the middle of this impeachment charade. Everyone knows about it. There was no evidence or support for this impeachment. Just it was an ideological windstorm driven by the hot air in the Democrat House and Senate. Yet when Nancy Pelosi was pushing through this impeachment and handing out souvenir pins after the signing of this impeachment, and then carrying those impeachment articles like the March of the Morons holding them like they're the Holy Grail walking through Congress, President Trump was rolling up his sleeves at his desk. He was looking at the situation globally and seeing that there was an outbreak in China. He heard about a patient that had actually been diagnosed here in the United States. So while they were passing out souvenir pens, our president was taking his pen out and signing a travel ban in the midst of utter calamity as far as in his administration, because they were under brutal attack by the Democrats and a lot of Republicans in name only. Yet he managed to keep his eye on the ball during that time and sign a travel ban, which I think was very strong and very appropriate for this virus and for this time. He did that on January 29th. Now, you're not going to hear anyone in the media applaud him for it. And he did declare that this was an emergency and that we need to pay attention to it. Now, did the media, in their almost post-coital glee after the impeachment hearing, while they were metaphorically smoking cigarettes and relaxing in the ambience of the fact that they impeached this president over nothing and that they were trying to destroy him, were they paying attention to the business of the people? Were they watching what was going on in the world? Were they listening to our president, or were they just trying to continue to undermine him and his administration? But the president did put it out that this virus was a problem. The Democrats just didn't recognize it, because thank God we have some journalistic sites, and they're very few. We can probably count them on one finger, that actually went back and looked at what the Democrats had to say during this time. And one of those sites is Grabian. And Grabian put together this supercut. And now this is the Democrats giving advice about coronavirus after the president had warned about it and the CDC began to talk about it in January. Cut one.
The risk to New Yorkers for coronavirus is low.
And our city preparedness is high.
This should not stop you from going about your life. Should not stop you from going to Chinatown and going out to eat. I'm going to do that today myself.
Come that to was China. The New York health commissioner. That was the New York mayor. Continue.
Here we are. We're again careful, safe, and come join us.
There is no concern at this time.
Stop for just a second. That was Nancy Pelosi in Chinatown saying, come to Chinatown. Here we are. We're again careful, safe. Come join us. Continue.
In our region.
The Department of Sanitation is ready for Mardi Gras 2020.
The facts are reassuring.
We want New Yorkers to go about their daily lives.
But there's really no need to panic and to avoid activities that we always do as New Yorkers. We are a hardy people.
Americans do not need to panic. What I would suggest, however, is that Americans take this as a wake-up call for seasonal flu.
There's very little threat here. This disease, even if you were to get it, basically acts like a common cold or flu.
So we're telling New Yorkers, go about your lives, take the subway, go out, enjoy life.
And certainly not to miss the parade next Sunday. I'm gonna be there.
If you had to, would you close down the borders?
No.
We need to be honest about the American people. With the American people about the fact that we can't keep people coming here from China.
And transmission is not that easy. I think there's been a misperception that coronavirus hangs in the air waiting to catch you. No, it takes direct person-to-person contact.
We also know that if it were likely to be transmitted casually, we would be seeing a lot more cases.
Right, because this is New York and you're in elevators and trains with everybody all the time.
Yeah, exactly, you bunch of morons. Now, I will tell you, a lot of things they said about this coronavirus are true. It doesn't float around in the air. Most people won't have a problem when they get it. So in essence, they really did understand this virus. No, I'm calling them morons. I'm calling them intellectually dishonest, because while the president was saying this is a crisis and we need to pay attention to it, they were just telling people, go out and mingle. You see, the way you deal with a virus, the way you deal with it is have quarantine stations, not quarantine the entire country. You have to have quarantine stations for people coming from countries that have this virus very prevalent. Just go to the CDC website and read about isolation and quarantine. They don't talk about the entire country, just specific areas.
These people could have been talking about social distancing and quarantine so we don't have to shut down an entire country or economy over something that will barely affect 80 to 90% of the American citizens. I'm not making light of this virus, but I am going to speak facts. We need to take away the drama. We need to take away the hyperbole and just speak to the truth of this virus, the truth of the situation that we find ourselves here in the United States of America. Because if we don't, and it may already be too late, I don't know. I'm not sure our children will ever wake up in the same country that we grew up in. And that will be a failure for us as American citizens, as patriots. And I, for one, I can't be quiet. Now, where are we now? You know, when I want to approach this, I was trying to think of some way I could speak to you, some way I could talk about this situation and make it simple. Not to get complex, not to run down any rabbit holes, but just to lay it out what we're seeing. So first, I want to start out where we were when this first came to light in the public. And that was in January. Where we were is what I just spoke about, where President Trump signed the travel ban. And as we knew more and more about this disease, President Trump, listening to his advisors, because remember, he's the president. He has advisors for a reason, experts in the field to talk to him. And I will tell you, I don't think some of them are serving President Trump that well. And shame on them for that. But they've done an okay job at first because we didn't know a lot, I guess, in the public sphere initially. So they were more draconian in their response to this by saying, we got to shut things down. We didn't really know where we were. And all kinds of models, epidemiological models about this virus were proposed and talked about. Of course, it doesn't surprise anyone that mainstream media started using those vanity metrics of number of positive cases around the world and big red circles throbbing on giant maps and graphics to just drive fear into the heart of the American people. But those of us that actually understand science and medicine, we're looking at this going, okay, I see number of positive cases, but when I go to our actual medical literature and scientific literature, people aren't really sure what that means, a positive case. I mean, when I go to UpToDate, one of the largest medical article collators for doctors to go and see summaries of a large amount of scientific peer-reviewed literature, they say, well, a positive case may mean that the patient has a disease. These are the initial testing. It may mean that the patient has a false positive or doesn't have the disease. It may mean the patient was exposed to the disease, or it may mean the patient has the disease and is infective. The bottom line is we're really not quite sure what it means, so we have to look at the subsets of data. We have to look at that initial metric and recognize it for what it is. It's a marker. But you got to look deeper to give it context and to make sense of it. Why do I say that? Because I've seen the CDC reporting sheets that request, once you have a positive test, then you need a significant amount of data to go along with that. Comorbid activities. Was the patient showing symptoms? Did they have a travel history? Who were they exposed to? There was a lot more subsets of data, and the most important of those were age, comorbid activities, hospitalizations, and obviously death. So with those important subsets of data that really will give us the information to drive our decision, why are the leaders supposedly out there in the medical community screaming about number of cases and not getting into the subset of data that you actually make decisions off of? I understand initially where we were. We had to do the worst case scenario. We had to prepare for the apocalypse. But now we have data. We have a lot of peer-reviewed data. We have data from our own country. We have data from around the world. We have reports that have been verified. So we have some actual numbers to look at. So we go from where we were to where we are now. And the problem I see with where we are now is that while we have this new data, we're still responding like where we were. There's a lot of modeling going on out there, and everyone seems to be attached to this gentleman, Christopher Murray. Christopher Murray works at the IHME, with the subtitle they just say. It's the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. It's an independent global health research center from the University of Washington. This independent health research center just recently received a 10-year, $279 million investment by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and I think that's awesome. But I would also wonder if they received that investment from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Bill Gates is coming out and has a certain stance that he is taking on this disease, are they independent of that $279 million investment? Because when I read about this, this is what this institute does. They expand the global burden of disease enterprise through greater and more precise estimates of disease, injuries, and risk factors on a national and, where possible, local levels. They're refining efforts to track spending related to health, both in the U.S. and around the world. They provide the world alternative health scenarios 25 years or more in the future. Isn't that awesome? We can have alternative health scenarios 25 years or more in the future. Well, they didn't predict this. And I'm not beating on them. I'm just saying, if you read this bullet point list, it's a globalist medical list. And Dr. Murray is constantly revising his numbers because every day he's missing his mark. Not by 5%, not by 10%, but by up to 60%. Because now we're supposed to have over 120,000 people hospitalized for this when we have just about 30,000. And the deaths are ultimately supposed to rise to 100, maybe 200,000 deaths, and we're at 4,700 since we started monitoring this. Now, compare that to the article I began the show with that said we had 4,000 deaths a week from flu season in 2018. We're not paying attention to the data. What we're seeing is folks that will get up there and put out these models, and they keep revising the numbers down, but they're not looking at the actual data we have, the actual trends we have, and so they're missing them, not a little bit, but a lot. So while we started out and we had to do everything we could because we didn't know what was going on, China was slow to provide us accurate information, and I have no reason to believe that they're actually providing us that now. We had to prep for worst case scenario, and President Trump did that. He blocked travel from China. But where we are now, we have more data, and we're finding out that it's not a one-size-fits-all. We're finding out that this virus spreads in densely populated urban areas. That's why you're seeing it in New York City. Where you're not seeing it a lot is in Staten Island, right next to New York, because it's not densely populated. You're not seeing it as intense in warmer climates that are spread out. But everyone wants us to focus on positive cases and tests instead of focusing on the actual data where we can make key decisions, and that's hospitalizations and deaths and comorbidities. Hospitalizations are the key because that's what taxes our infrastructure. Comorbidities and fatalities, we also need to identify those so we can target those patients that are at risk for earlier treatment, earlier care, and put our resources behind those folks. Because again, one size doesn't fit all. It never has in medicine, so why are we doing it now? It never has in evaluating diseases, so why are we doing it now? We know enough about this disease to know that sheltering in place, everyone not moving around, is not, quote unquote, flattening the curve in every geographical location. In fact, it's hurting the economy. It's destroying the economy, and it's destroying the psyche of the American people. With the current data, we should focus our resources on the hotspots because we know where they are. New York, New Orleans, California. Not all over California, just San Francisco, Washington, the places we have actual hotspots. And it would be nice to know the ages and the underlying medical problems that these patients that are being hospitalized and dying from this disease. It'd be nice to have that specific data because you know what? It's being collected, so why is it not being reported? We need to push past the initial positive case metrics and start paying attention solely to hospitalizations, comorbidities, and death. That way we can target those at risk for hospitalization, those at risk for death, and better help them. We need to pay attention to what's going on. It's time to fight smarter, not harder. It's time to seek efficiencies. We know where we need resources. We need to relax the standard in areas that aren't affected as greatly or don't have a lot of hospitalizations and deaths, like the state of Texas. We just need to focus our resources on hospitalizations with robust monitoring and social spacing for everyone else, because that's what's recommended by the CDC. So why is the entire United States not even following the CDC recommendations? Because it, again, it's not broad brush and it's not one size fits all. With the data we have, we now need real-time assessment. We need to adjust and tailor our response and surge our capacity and support efficiently where it's needed, like New York City. Now, I could beat on New York City because it's true. They had a failing medical infrastructure to begin with, but now's not the time. Now's the time to support them, and that's what our president's doing. We need to surge into the areas where resources are needed, and we need to relax restrictions where they aren't. And if I could speak to President Trump, I would very respectfully say, sir, your response and your instincts are spot on, but you're not being served by everyone around you efficiently. It's no longer time to react to what if. It's time to respond to what is. Hospitalizations, comorbid factors, and deaths are the only metrics that should be studied. I believe our president needs to convene a small group of doctors and epidemiologists that understand the actual data and can message. You might wonder who that group could be. Well, I've put together a small list. I've been collaborating indirectly and directly with some of these folks. And these are folks that are very smart, like John Ioannidis, I probably pronounced his name wrong, who is the Reinberg Chair of Disease Prevention, Professor of Medicine, of Health Research and Policy, of Biomedical Data Science and Statistics, and the Co-Director of Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford. He's the most cited scientist and physician in the world, and he has also come out publicly and said we are overreacting to the data and we are not reacting to the correct metrics, partly because we don't even know what they are. Michael Levitt, a biophysicist and professor of structural biology at Stanford University, who's a Nobel laureate. I would talk to him, sir. I would talk to Aaron Ben David, an infectious disease physician and associate professor of medicine. He's affiliated with the Stanford Health Policy Center for Population Health Sciences, the Woods Institute for the Environment, and the Division of Infectious Diseases. You have David Reimer, associate professor at the University of Colorado. You have Dr. Paul Offit, the Director of Vaccine Education and Attending Physician in the Division of Infectious Disease at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. I would also recommend you talk to Aaron Jin. He co-founded the Lincoln Network, data science expert and technologist, and he wrote Evidence Over Hysteria, COVID-19. And when I read it, I reached out to him because he was spot on. Sir, there are people out there that understand this problem, and they don't have an ideological axe to grind, but they're just patriots that want to see this country move forward and prosper. So I believe that there are individuals out here. I believe there's a small group that you could convene that would help. Because, sir, I believe you need to turn on the majority of the economy. My message would be that we have months of data and are going to adjust course. We are no longer going to react, like I said, to what if, but start responding to what is. We will support the few large blooms and release the rest of the country to resume life while constantly monitoring and practicing social distancing as needed and as recommended, I would add, by the CDC. Because what we do know is this is a disease that targets a specific group of people and does not survive in certain temperatures and environments. We will save our economy and small businesses by using a scalpel to target and support those at risk and eliminating the crushing mandates of a broad brush reaction. We are a self-governed people. Today, we need to move forward as a free nation and not a country ruled by panic merchants. Small businesses employ 80% of workers. The small business owners have been frantically filling out these SBA 7A loan and grant applications for stimulus that was passed earlier this week. But as of today, the banks don't really have a clear understanding of how to pass out those funds, although I think they're going to by tomorrow from what I understand. The banks are taking those applications, though. And if they don't fund them very quickly because they're waiting on rules for funding, that delay in funding will push most small businesses into an uncontrolled panic and bankruptcy, I believe. Democrats will take to the Sunday shows this weekend and push a narrative that they passed the stimulus and that it's just the incompetence of the president's administration as the reason for delay. And I will tell you, it's not the president's incompetence. He has done an outstanding job. It's just the unconscionable moral decay of the Democrat Party that are using a crisis for political gain. But if we're not careful as conservatives, it will be a political bloodbath because people expect relief and they're not getting it. I know this because I'm on the front lines in small business. Again, panic and bankruptcy. Furloughed workers will get more than their regular salary on unemployment and will have no incentive to return to work. Small businesses will be shuttered or taken over by big companies. The majority of private medical practices, and this is important to note, won't survive and will retire or go to hospitals, crippling the healthcare infrastructure. And when I mean cripple the healthcare infrastructure, that's the problem in Italy. It's a socialist system. There are very few private practice primary care doctors, so most of the people, the majority of the populace, use the ER as their primary care, and that's why they're crumbling when they hit a crisis. This virus is an apocalyptic. However, it has been co-opted by an ideology that is. I need a doctor. Call me a doctor. I need a doctor, doctor, to bring me back to The Scalpel is sponsored by Z-Bones Headphones. Their flagship product, Z-Bones Bone Conduction Headphones, are unlike any Bluetooth listening device you have ever used. They're really amazing to hear with. Z-Bones Headphones work through bone conduction. The comfortable pads rest next to your ear, not in your ear. The sound is transmitted through the bones to your eardrum. With an open ear design, nothing is stuck in your ear, which means you maintain situational awareness or environmental awareness by hearing your surroundings. You can still hear the fullness of your music, though, or whatever podcast, hopefully ours, that you're listening to. You can even use Z-Bones while using ear protection at sporting events like races or at the shooting range. Z-Bones Bone Conduction Headphones are a Bluetooth device that work with any iOS or Android phone system or tablet, and they give you 6 hours of call time and 7 days of standby. You can put on a cap and have your Z-Bones on, and you can't even hardly tell you have anything on while you're listening to music. This is a cool headset. It's innovative technology, and I frankly love it. And I'm very happy that they've chosen to sponsor us. So go check them out. Get them at zbones.io. Use the discount code SCALPEL70 for a 10% discount. And be sure to use the Z-Bones when you're listening to the Scalpel podcast. Welcome back to The Scalpel. This is Dr. Keith Rose. I've had a lot of people reach out to me and ask me why this is happening, why we're responding the way we are, why we're not paying attention to the data, and why would even Democrat politicians push so hard to what it appears to a lot of folks in business to destroy the United States of America economically, which would cause a fracture in this country. I always tell them, because they're Marxists, they're closet Marxists. And everyone pushes back, oh my gosh, they're not. That's just their ideology. No, it's really not. But again, I believe in history. I believe in experience, and I read. And this is what I believe is the philosophy of a lot of the folks on the hard left and some of the globalists that seek to destroy our country. I'll just read it to you. The Duties of the Revolutionary Towards Himself. This is by Sergei Nietzsche, 1869, in the Revolutionary Catechism. This is about Marxism, and he wrote, the duties of the revolutionary towards himself. The revolutionary is a doomed man. The revolutionary knows that he has broken all the bonds which tie him to the social order and the civilized world with all its laws, moralities, and customs. He is their implacable enemy, and if he continues to live with them, it is only in order to destroy them more speedily. The revolutionary despises all doctrines and refuses to accept the mundane sciences, leaving them for future generations. He knows only one science, the science of destruction. The object is perpetually the same, the surest and quickest way of destroying the whole filthy order. The revolutionary despises public opinion. He despises and hates the existing social morality in all its manifestations. For him, morality is everything which contributes to the triumph of the revolution. Immoral and criminal is everything that stands in his way. Does that sound familiar? The revolutionary is dedicated man, merciless towards the state and towards the educated classes. Tyrannical towards himself, he must be tyrannical towards others. Night and day, he must have but one thought, one aim, merciless destruction, striving cold-bloodedly and indefatigably toward this end. He never gets tired. He must be prepared to destroy himself and to destroy with his own hands everything that stand in the path of the revolution. The relations of the revolutionary towards society, the revolutionary enters the world of the state, of the privileged classes, of the so-called civilization, and he lives in this world for only one purpose, bringing about its speedy and total destruction. He is not a revolutionary if he has any sympathy for this world. He should not hesitate to destroy any position, any place, or any man in this world. He must hate everyone, everything in it, with equal hatred. Sergei Nietzsche, 1869, The Revolutionary Catechism. When I read that, all I could think about was, why are we passing a spending bill to aid folks that are suffering more than anyone can remember in our nation's history from a disease that over half of this bill is just for pet projects that will further fracture the economy, further push us towards socialism and destruction of the civil society? Why would anyone do that? They believe in the revolution. They're revolutionaries. They're socialist. They're Marxist. Why would anyone say we need another stimulus bill when the first one for people hasn't even been distributed and we haven't even evaluated whether it was effective or not? Because they're revolutionaries. They have to bring about the destruction of everything. But, oh, they're doing it, I think. And why are they doing it? Don't they know it's going to destroy their children and their grandchildren? And then I go back and read this. They're only here to bring about a speedy and total destruction. They can have no sympathy. They have to destroy everything in their way, even if it includes destroying themselves. Because as Sergei Nietzsche says, a revolutionary must hate everyone and everything in it with equal hatred. I would tell you the only way we're going to solve this is the opposite. Our country's headed in a bad direction, but I want to encourage everyone to show love. We're going to come into some tough times. I think the economy could get a lot worse. I pray the president will get better advice and will turn on the economy quickly. But if you see someone struggling that can't get their relief funds yet, cook them a meal. Reach out to your neighbor, not with selfish ambition about destruction, but reaching out to see if they need something. Check on your neighbor. Do they need medications? Do they need some food? Do they need some water? I think America is great, like de Tocqueville said, because America is good. We have laws that tell us what we can do, but we have morals that tell us what we can't. And I pray that that spirit in America is still here today. Pay attention to what's going on. This is a bad disease, but it's not a disease that we should be sheltering in place. Reach out to your local, state, and national representatives and let them know what you think. Keep the faith, because that's what's going to win the day. It's not the nihilism of the revolutionary that created this country, but the faith of true patriots that believed there was nothing and no event so great that it couldn't be conquered. Say a prayer tonight, hug your loved ones, and do everything you can to keep freedom rolling.
Head high, protest line, freedom scribbled on your sign. Headline, New York Times, standing on the edge of a revolution. Hey, hey, just obey your secret safe with the NSA. And God we trust, or the CIA, standing on the edge of a revolution.
The Scalpel with Dr. Keith Rose. The Scalpel is proudly sponsored by Z-Bones Bone Conducting Headphones. Learn more at zbones.io. Subscribe to The Scalpel wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at The Scalpel Podcast, on Twitter at The Scalpel Edge, or the website scalpeledge.com.